Hi, this is Brother Peter Diamond here, and I was going to be speaking about a book which I recently read called The Salvation of Non-Catholics by Winfried Herbst, SDS. This book was originally published in 1953 with the local approval of the pre-Vatican II authorities. Now, why is this book significant? This book is particularly significant because it was recently reprinted and republished by a so-called traditionalist group, a Sedevacantist independent group called the Catholic Research Institute. And this group is affiliated with a so-called traditionalist priest named Father Kevin Valancourt. And the heresies against the dogma, outside the Church there is no salvation, that are contained in this book, The Salvation of Non-Catholics, are quite astounding. And it's very important to consider because it reveals how the traditionalists and the Sedevacantists who believe in baptism of desire utterly deny the dogma outside the Church there is no salvation. Now, some people might say, well, even if this particular book does contain clear heresy against the dogma outside the Church there is no salvation, that doesn't prove that the other traditionalists who accept baptism of desire would say the same thing. Well, actually, it does go a long way in demonstrating that essentially all of them accept this heresy because, number one, we've demonstrated in our material that they basically all believe in the same thing on this issue, that baptism of desire can apply to people who don't even accept Christ, who even reject Christ, etc. But to further illustrate the link between all of these groups and their denial of the dogma, this group called the Catholic Research Institute, which republished this book I'm going to be speaking about, The Salvation of Non-Catholics, also published the booklet called Father Feeney, the Pope Has Spoken. And in this talk, I'm going to be discussing this booklet as well. And this booklet was significant because certain individuals who had agreed with us on the dogma outside the Church there is no salvation, or at least indicated to us that they were in agreement that you had to be a baptized Catholic, that you truly had to have the Catholic faith to be saved, were persuaded by this booklet, Father Feeney, the Pope Has Spoken, to abandon their position. And so it's important to consider some of the things in it, and which I will do after I talk about the other booklet. And before I get to this, The Salvation of Non-Catholics, in the front of the booklet Father Feeney, the Pope Has Spoken, published by the same group, it has approval from Bishop Robert McKenna, Father Martin Stepanek, Father Kevin Valancourt, and Patrick Henry Omler. So all four of those individuals are agreeing with what's in Father Feeney, the Pope Has Spoken. And in the back of Father Feeney, the Pope Has Spoken, there is an advertisement and a promotion for this other book called The Salvation of Non-Catholics. So you can see how it's all linked together. And those individuals that I mentioned are recognized as Catholics by basically all the other traditionalists and Sedevacantist priests who accept baptism of desire. So what I'm going to be covering is basically reflective of what is believed by all of these different groups. So let's get to this book, The Salvation of Non-Catholics, which I have to say is probably the most heretical book I've ever seen in terms of one that purports to deliver the pre-Vatican II teaching on outside the Church there is no salvation. As I said, it was published with approval in 1953, which is quite revealing. It had the imprimi potest from Jerome Jacobs, which means it is able to be printed. It also had a nihil obstat and an imprimatur. Now, on page 5 of this book, it fields the question, is it true that all non-Catholics are simply excluded from eternal salvation? Answer, it is not true. So it says that non-Catholics can be saved. On page 7, it expounds upon this and expands upon its belief, and it says that a heathen, quote, who has never heard even the name of Christ, who obeys the natural law according to his lights, and dies a heathen to all appearances. So this is an example it's giving of a heathen who can be saved. So someone who obviously is not a Catholic. On page 10, it goes on to explicitly state that people can be saved who are, quote, outside the church. Regarding the salvation of those who remain outside the church, we know, as the Catechism says, that they who remain outside the Catholic Church through no grave fault of their own, and who do not know it is the true church, can be saved by making use of the graces which God gives them, end quote. Now, I'm not going to be repeating in detail the dogmatic definitions that outside the church there is no salvation. But if that's a truth rather than just a fiction, which Catholics know it is a truth, it's a defined dogma, it's a divinely revealed truth, then that means that there are no exceptions. If people can be saved outside the church, then the dogma outside the church there is no salvation is simply a myth. It's simply a lie. So what we have here is blatant heresy, a word-for-word denial of the dogma. Now what's very interesting is, in this same context, it goes on to say that these people who can be saved outside the church cannot be called Catholics. Quote, quoting from page 11, can those people be called Catholic? I maintain that they cannot. While I do not for an instant doubt that they belong to the church in some way, I maintain that they cannot be called Catholic. End quote. So, he's saying that these individuals who are saved are not even Catholic. Well, that in itself is blatantly heretical, because it's been defined at least four times that you must have the Catholic faith. Pope Eugene IV at the Council of Florence, Session 8, 1439, dogmatically reaffirming the Athanasian Creed, said, quote, whoever wishes to be saved before all things, it is necessary that he holds the Catholic faith. Unless a person keeps this faith whole and undefiled, without a doubt he will perish eternally. Pope Pius IV at the Council of Trent proclaimed solemnly, this true Catholic faith, outside of which no one can be saved. End quote. Pope Benedict XIV, Nuper ad Nos, March 16, 1743, quote, this faith of the Catholic Church, without which no one can be saved, end quote. Pope Pius IX, First Vatican Council, Profession of Faith, quote, this true Catholic faith, outside of which none can be saved, end quote. So, on page 11, we have a blatant denial of the dogma that you need the Catholic faith, a bold admission that the people they think are saved are not even Catholic. So this is just putrid and horrible heresy, a total denial of the dogma, and all of the definitions excluded all exceptions. Never once, and there have been more than seven infallible definitions on outside the church, there is no salvation, never once were any exceptions mentioned or any clarifications. What we have here is a new religion, a departure from traditional Catholic dogma, an invention. Now, it gets even worse, believe it or not. On page, moving along to page 21, it utters even new heresies. It says, fields the question, do Protestants go to heaven? This is page 21. If they live good lives? Yes, also Protestants, and even those who do not attend any church can save their souls. Everyone who lives faithfully according to his conscience will save his soul. End quote. So here we have the statement that you can be saved in any religion, any church, and everyone who lives faithfully according to his conscience can save his soul. Well, obviously this is gross heresy, pure religious indifferentism, and obviously contrary to the dogmatic definition of Pope Eugene IV, in which he declared that all the pagans, all the heretics, all the schismatics, all the Jews, nobody, unless he's joined to the Catholic Church, can be saved. But also, this is almost exactly what is condemned by Pope Pius IX in the Syllabus of Errors from 1864, error number 15, which is condemned, says, quote, "Every man is free to embrace and profess that religion which he, led by the light of reason, thinks to be the true religion." Condemned. And so that's what you have here asserted in this booklet, promulgated and republished by Seda Vacantist so-called traditionalists, a so-called traditionalist group. It gets even worse, because not only does it say that someone can be saved no matter what church he attends, whoever lives according to his conscience, quote, but it even says on page 22 that someone who hates the church can be saved. And it's describing how these people and who these people are. It says, they are in some way related to the church without knowing it, in spite of themselves often enough. For even when they hate the Catholic Church, they really do not hate the church, but what they think it is. So we've seen that they say that a heathen can be saved, someone who hates the church can be saved. Clearly, they believe that someone who hates the Lord can be saved. And this is important to consider for a moment, because obviously we can quote and have quoted all the dogmatic definitions which declare that all the pagans, all the Jews, all the Muslims, etc. are lost. But I would ask people simply to focus in on the dogmas which declare that there is one Lord and one faith. Okay? There may have been many dogmatic definitions reiterating this truth. And of course, everyone knows that the church is one in faith. But if you think more deeply about the meaning and the significance of that, the evil behind this heresy that we're covering really comes out. For instance, Pope Clement V at the Council of Vienne, in its dogmatic definition, stated, there is one universal church outside of which there is no salvation, for all of whom there is one Lord, one faith, and one baptism. For all of whom there is one Lord. There is one Lord. Now, if someone hates the Lord, okay, could he have the same Lord as someone who accepts the Lord? Someone who believes in Jesus, and therefore accepts the one Lord of the Catholic Church, could he be said to have the same Lord, the one Lord, as someone, another man who hates Jesus? Of course not. It's absurd. It's insane. It's outrageous. But that's what these people are saying. So one should hopefully be able to see that by holding this heresy, they completely deny and make a mockery of the unity of faith in the church, the dogma that all in the church have one faith. They do not believe that the church is one in faith. It actually gets even worse in this booklet, believe it or not. It says that on page 24, well, before I get to that, let's look at page 23. It also says in this booklet that most non-Catholics are of goodwill. So the impression you're given is that it's open to the idea that most non-Catholics can be saved. And that's one of the points I want to emphasize, is that once you or a person holds this heresy that it's possible to be saved as a heathen in another religion, okay, then one has to be open to everything. Because at that point, one couldn't have any internal conviction. There's no barrier holding back any kind of salvation in any religion for any number of people, because the dogma says that none of them are saved. So once you depart from that, you would have to be open to the fact or the idea that most non-Catholics are saved. And that's what we see here. For instance, on page 23, it says, while there are many who are practically pagans, the non-Catholic, for the most part, is a well-meaning person. So most non-Catholics could probably be saved, according to this. We can see how close this is to the Vatican II Church, and I'll get back to that. But on page 24 and 25, actually, this is very interesting. It takes the heresy to a new level. The question is asked, quote, is it possible for a non-Catholic in all sincerity to be convinced that his own religion is true. If possible, isn't he obliged in conscience to practice his religion? Answer: yes, it is certainly possible for a non-Catholic to be convinced that his own religion is true. No doubt there are many such non-Catholics, especially among the common people. And such a one is obliged in conscience to continue to practice his religion. So he's saying that someone in a false religion not only can be saved in that false religion, but would be obliged in conscience to follow his false religion. This is simply apostasy, and another expression of the indifferentist heresy condemned in the Syllabus of Errors number 15, which I already quoted. It also says, on page 26, it even says, hence the non-Catholic you mention would sin if he would not practice his religion. So he would sin if he didn't practice his false religion, according to a booklet published by the Catholic Research Institute, a so-called traditionalist organization, so-called Sedevacantist organization. It also says, and this is very important, that if you find someone who is following a false religion and outside the church and probably not going to be convinced of the Catholic faith according to what you think, then you shouldn't even preach to him. On page 28 and 29, it addresses this issue. It says, well then, if pagans and Protestants are saved, why not leave them in their errors? And it says on page 29, it is a work of Christian charity, of love of one's neighbor, to lead one from error to truth. But if one is manifestly in good faith, and it is clear that he would not embrace the truth, prudence may suggest that we do not disturb his good faith. Wow. Very interesting. So, and we can see how this has been adopted in practice, because the missionary spirit obviously has been killed since Vatican II, and even in the 40s and 50s before Vatican II, because people adopted this idea. They lost the faith and the conviction that you have to be Catholic to be saved. Excuse me. And people will preach and they will act upon what they internally believe. And so if a person isn't internally convinced that it's really necessary to be Catholic, he's not going to make the extra effort to preach the necessity of the Catholic faith to his friends and neighbors. And so that's why we saw the breakdown of the missionary effort. That's also why we see in the traditionalist movement, the people who believe in baptism of desire are essentially without evangelization zeal. They're simply not interested in converting people because they're not convinced they have to be converted to be saved. And another point I want to make is that what this individual is saying, and this obviously expressed what most of the priests in the 40s and 50s believed, they all denied this dogma pretty much, most of them at least, is basically what the Vatican II Church is saying on salvation. And so this is relevant for our position that you can attend the Mass. We believe certain people who hold a heretical position, maybe a certain priest who's more reasonable, who's not notorious or imposing about his heresy, not a priest like this, but someone who would be more reasonable on the issues, although he would be holding a heretical position, we believe you could go to him without supporting him. Because if one holds the position that it's absolutely off limits to attend the Mass of any priest who's holding a heretical position, well, then you would have had to have stayed home in the 40s and 50s and told everyone else to stay home under pain of mortal sin and heresy, because basically all the priests, as this book provides further evidence of, were holding a heretical position at that time, clearly denying the dogma. And so it's really interesting how this represents the total breakdown of faith in the years before Vatican II. And what I'm quoting here is, it's very dark. I mean, this is dark stuff. I mean, someone who would believe this is not remotely Christian. He's not remotely Catholic. And what's scary is that this is what most of these traditionalists believe in baptism of desire. And what's so deceptive and frightening is that it doesn't always come out. It only comes out when they're queried, or when they happen to be addressing what they think on that point, it very often, you know, sits under the surface. And so some people will say, no, my priest doesn't believe that. Well, they do. And someone who would believe this cannot be saved because he has rejected the faith of the church. He doesn't have the grace of faith. And so now that I've covered some of the main heresies in this booklet, let me just recap quickly before I move on. It says a heathen can be saved. It says people outside the church can be saved. It says that non-Catholics can be saved. It says the people who are saved cannot even be called Catholic. It says that people are obliged to practice false religions if they really believe them to be true. People can be saved who attend any church whatsoever. It says that if people are, quote, in good faith and probably wouldn't believe, don't preach to them. Now, the same group, the Catholic Research Institute, published another booklet called Father Feeney, the Pope Has Spoken. And this booklet, to our disappointment, actually persuaded a few people we know who claim to believe in the dogma outside the church there is no salvation. When you read the booklet, it's quite pathetic that anyone would be persuaded in any way by this booklet. But before I get to that, the booklet is basically a defense of the document Suprema Hoc Sacra, which was the August 8, 1949 letter, supposedly from the Holy Office, against Father Leonard Feeney, also known as Protocol 12249. I'm not going to give the background on that letter. It's in our material. It's in our book. But before I discuss what's in the booklet, Father Feeney, the Pope Has Spoken, it's important to pin down the main heresy of Suprema Hoc Sacra. Now, we've criticized it and pointed out the heresies in it in other places, but I want to focus on one heresy in it, because both of these booklets, The Salvation of Non-Catholics and Father Feeney, the Pope Has Spoken, are basing their heretical new understanding of outside the church there is no salvation on Suprema Hoc Sacra. They thought that the church clarified what it means in this document. Now, this document was a letter written by Cardinal Marchetti Salvigiani, a cardinal of the Holy Office, to Archbishop Richard Cushing of Boston against Father Feeney on outside the church there is no salvation. It was not infallible. Holy Office letters and decrees, as we've pointed out, are not infallible. There are two forms of documents that can come out of the Holy Office. There's common form documents and specific form documents, or they can be approved by the Pope in common form or specific form. For instance, if the Holy Office issues a decree and it basically briefs the Pope on what it's saying, and the Pope says, okay, go ahead and publish it, and it publishes it, that's called common form approval. He doesn't sign it, he doesn't issue his own document to promulgate it himself, or to specifically comment on it, or reinforce its authority. That's called common form approval. Then there's specific form approval, which is of much greater weight and very different. That's when the Holy Office issues a decree, but it's backed up by a specific document or bull from a pope. When a pope does that and solemnly reiterates a decree of the Holy Office, then it becomes infallible and absolutely magisterial. An example of that would be Pope Pius X, when he published a bull solemnly reaffirming the decree of the Holy Office, which condemned the errors of the modernists. And the decree of the Holy Office was called Lamentabili from 1907, and Pope St. Pius X issued his own bull in which he specifically reiterated and promulgated that decree. So that's an example of specific form approval. When a pope does that, that's absolutely magisterial. But common form approvals are not. Okay, now this decree, Suprema Hoc Sacra, wasn't even a normal common form document because it was private. Okay, basically no one knew about it except the parties involved for a few years. And so it was a very unusual document. But most importantly, it's blatantly heretical, as I will show. And Before I get to that, I will say that the people who believe that Suprema Hak Sacra is binding, the people who believe that it says that it represents the Pope speaking officially, would have to hold that geocentrism is the binding magisterial teaching of the Church, because, as we've pointed out before, the Holy Office condemned the denial of geocentrism in 1616 and 1633. Okay? But basically all the groups who hold that Suprema Hak Sacra was an example of the official teaching of the Church do not hold that geocentrism is the official teaching of the Church, which binds every man. So they show their profound hypocrisy and condemn themselves out of their own mouths by not binding people to geocentrism. When you had numerous acts of the Holy Office condemning the denial of geocentrism, but later on, in the 1700s and 1800s, and then Pope Benedict XV, the Holy Office, the Congregation of the Index, reverts itself on the issue of geocentrism, proving that a common decree of the Holy Office is not infallible. Now, Suprema Hak Sacra, I want to focus on one heresy in it, which absolutely proves that it's blatantly heretical. And this is important because I actually had a long conversation with one individual who's a so-called traditionalist writer and speaker, and he was refusing to admit that Suprema Hak Sacra was heretical. I was trying to illustrate to him that it is heretical. He refused to admit that it was, strictly speaking, heretical. Now here's the heresy in it. Quoting from Suprema Hak Sacra, quote, towards the end of the same encyclical letter, and it's making reference to Pius XII, when most affectionately inviting to unity those who do not belong to the body of the Church, these by no means he excludes from eternal salvation. End quote. Now, it's trying to use Pius XII for what it says here, but there's nothing in Pius XII which says what I'm going to be critiquing. Okay? So I just wanted to make that point. But here's the main heresy in Suprema Hak Sacra. When most affectionately inviting to unity those who do not belong to the body of the Catholic Church, he mentions those who are ordered to the Redeemer's mystical body by a sort of unconscious desire and intention, and these he by no means excludes from eternal salvation. End quote. Now focus in on this. It says that those who do not belong to the body of the Catholic Church, these by no means he excludes from salvation. So someone can be saved who does not belong to the body of the Catholic Church. Well, the Catholic Church is a body. The Church is the mystical body. If someone can be saved without belonging to the body, then someone can be saved without belonging to the Church, because the Church is a body. And I want to give some magisterial statements on this. At the Fifth Lateran Council, Pope Leo X said, quote, the mystical body, the Church, corpore mystico. Pope St. Pius X in Edite Sepe said, quote, the Church, the mystical body of Christ. Pope Leo XII, quod hoc, 1824, quote, his mystical body. Now, even more importantly, Pope Eugene IV, ex cathedra, Council of Florence, quote, the unity of this ecclesiastical body is so strong that only for those who abide in it are the sacraments of the Church of benefit for salvation. End quote. So it's dogmatically defined that one must be incorporated into the body to be saved, because the Church is a body. So there's no salvation without the body, without union with the body, because that would be equivalent to saying that you can be saved without union with the Church. And this is really made clear by Pope Pius XI in Mortalium Animos, number 10, quote, for since the mystical body of Christ, in the same manner as his physical body is one, compacted and fitly joined together, it would be foolish and out of place to say that the mystical body is made up of members which are disunited and scattered abroad. Whosoever, therefore, is not united with the body is no member of it, neither is he in communion with Christ its head. End quote. So, Whoever, therefore, is not united with the body is no member or part of it. So that means that what Suprema Hak Sakra says, that those who do not belong to the body are not excluded from salvation, is clearly heretical. And if what I've quoted so far doesn't prove that, I'll quote Monsignor Joseph Clifford Fenton. He was a pre-Vatican II theologian, a defender of Suprema Hak Sakra, a defender of baptism as our. He even admitted this. Quote, he admitted that to say that someone can be part of the soul of the church without belonging to the body is theologically wrong. Quote, the most important and the most widely employed of all the inadequate explanations of the church's necessity for salvation was the one that centered around a distinction between the body and the soul of the Catholic Church. There were several books and articles claiming that while the soul of the church was in some way not separated from the body, it was actually more extensive than this body, end quote. So he's distancing himself from this idea of the soul of the church being more extensive to the than the body. But he's too blind and heretical to realize that the very document he defends, Suprema Hak Sakra, teaches the very thing he's criticizing. Okay? So we can use Fenton to prove that Suprema Hak Sakra is heretical. It's blatantly heretical. And if someone defends it, he denies the dogma. He denies the dogma that the church is a body and that the church is necessary. I could quote other things on this point, but I wanted to pin down that main heresy because Suprema Hak Sakra is the foundation for not only the post-Vatican II denial of the dogma, the traditionalist baptism of desire denial of the dogma, but what is promoted in these two booklets I've been speaking about. And so now I want to move on to this booklet, Father Feeney, the Pope Has Spoken. It's very short, and basically all it is it gets into showing the procedures of the Holy Office, how the Pope is the prefect of the Holy Office, how they meet and brief the Pope, etc. And so basically what they want to accomplish in this booklet is create the impression that since this letter, Suprema Hak Sakra, was sent out by a cardinal of the Holy Office, that it's unthinkable that Pope Pius XII couldn't have agreed with it. The document even says he agrees with it. And therefore, the Pope must have spoken, and it must be the teaching of the Church. Now, this booklet is only appealing and only persuasive to someone who has faith in the man, rather than faith in the office, okay? It's only appealing to people who really don't believe. They're only persuaded by the man, rather than the office. Because a Catholic would immediately conclude, when confronted with this type of argument, wait a second, the Church has already defined the dogma outside the Church's salvation many times. Never were any exceptions mentioned. Never was it asserted that you can be united to the Church without being a member of it, without knowing the faith, without having the faith, etc. So if these people of the Holy Office, and even if Pius XII agreed with this, you don't revise or change your faith, you don't modify the dogma, you would have to conclude that Pius XII departed from dogma. That's what a Catholic would conclude. But a person who has faith only in the man, not in the office, revises his faith based on what the man says, because his faith is not rooted in the power, in the protection of the office exercised by the predecessors in the Holy See. So that's a point I will make, and it's really disgusting that anyone would be persuaded by this booklet or think that it's actually strong at all. So essentially the argument of the booklet is that Pius XII was involved in the promulgation of this document and therefore it was necessarily the document of the magisterium. And as I mentioned, that's easily refuted by the fact that there's nothing specifically from Pius XII which teaches this kind of heresy. Second, it's very plausible that during a briefing of the Holy Office in which they're briefing him about what they will be promulgating, that they simply gave him a bare-bones explanation of what they're going to be saying. For instance, we have a priest who is departing from Catholic teaching on salvation. We're going to be writing a document which addresses that issue. And he said, okay. And without getting into the specifics, with the amount of activities that these congregations are involved with, it's very plausible that something like that happens very frequently. And so without any specific document from the Pope himself teaching the same kind of thing, one could not say that this proves that that was necessarily his authoritative teaching. And thirdly, as I said, even if he did agree with this document, then he was simply departing from the Catholic faith. And the documents from the councils and the dogmatic definitions absolutely contradict what is promulgated by Suprema Hoc Sacra. And to further prove that the opinion of a pope does not represent necessarily the teaching of the church, we could look at the chapter in church history in the late 800s and the early 900s which surrounded the Synod of the Corpse. This was a notorious chapter of church history, one of the darker periods of church history, in which you had, in 897, Pope Formosus was condemned for supposedly violating canon law by Pope Stephen VII. Now, by all accounts, or most accounts, Pope Formosus was a decent pope who did not deserve to be condemned. But for probably political reasons, Pope Stephen VII condemned him in 897 for supposedly violating canon law. Pope Stephen VII dug Pope Formosus's body up, sat it in a chair, dressed it up in pontifical robes, pronounced it guilty, then threw his body in the river. This was known as the Synod of the Corpse. Okay? Some years later, however, this condemnation of Formosus by Pope Stephen VII was overturned by Pope Theodore II. So Pope Theodore II overturned the condemnation of Formosus, which had been issued by Pope Stephen VII. This was backed up by another pope, Pope John IX, in 898. He reigned after Pope Theodore II, and he agreed with Theodore that the condemnation of Formosus by Stephen VII had been unjust. However, a few years after John IX, Pope Sergius III became the pope from 904 to 911. He held a different view on the Pope Formosus issue. He went so far as to praise the memory of Stephen VII while still condemning that of Pope Formosus. So you had Pope Theodore II and Pope John IX who held that Formosus had been unjustifiably condemned, whereas you had Sergius III and Stephen VII who held that Formosus had been justifiably condemned. Now, if that doesn't prove that the position of the man is not necessarily the position of the office, I don't know what does. So the point here, as it relates to this issue, is that even if Pius XII had agreed with Suprema Hoc Sacra, that would just prove that he was a heretic. It wouldn't prove that that's the teaching of the Catholic Church. It would prove it to someone who has no faith. It would prove it to someone who has faith in the man, not in the office. But it wouldn't prove it to someone who has a rooted faith and knows that when the Church teaches and defines its dogma, that that is the truth revealed from heaven, which cannot be altered or revised. As St. Paul says in Galatians 1:8, though we are an angel from heaven, preach a gospel other than that which you have received, let him be anathema. And so what happened was, basically, God allowed this non-infallible document to come out, which basically condemned and reinvented the church's teaching on salvation. And it gave the impression that the church itself had revised its teaching, which is impossible. The church can't revise its teaching, and did not revise its teaching because this was not the teaching of the church, but rather the heretical teaching of certain men. And so all that being said, there's no specific evidence that Pius XII agreed with that, and his official teaching goes right in the face of what Suprema Hoc Sacra says. And so that's basically what the booklet Father Fien, the Pope, has spoken is all about. It's all about, you know, how important the Holy Office is. Now, to further illustrate the bad will of the authors of this booklet, the faithlessness, this is the type of thing that they complain in the book. A lot of it is a personal attack on Father Feeney and his group at the time, the St. Benedict Center. Now, obviously those who are familiar with our material know we don't agree with every opinion Father Feeney held. However, we believe that he was strongly defending the dogma at that time, in the 50s and the 40s, against the pack of modernists and heretics who were holding that you don't have to be Catholic, holding the very heresy that we covered in this book, The Salvation of Non-Catholics. And Father Feeney clearly believed that it was truly necessary to accept Jesus Christ and the Catholic faith and baptism. And he was defending that against people who were denying it. But basically, much of this little booklet is simply a personal attack about his group. And on page 26, it really illustrates their blindness, their folly, their bad will. It says, quote, "When St. Benedict Center transformed its lecture program into St. Benedict Center School, neither the Society of Jesus nor the Archdiocese of Boston was consulted," end quote. So they're criticizing St. Benedict Center for transforming its lecture program into a school without consulting the Jesuit order or the Archdiocese. Oh boy, that's really, really bad, isn't it? The fact that they would actually dare to transform their lecture program into a school without consulting the Jesuits or the Archdiocese. The Jesuits, who at that time were holding that you don't have to be Catholic, the diocese which that time, whose head was Richard Cushing, who was mocking the dogma outside the church, there's no salvation, of course they wouldn't consult them. Who would? Those people had embraced modernist heresy, so who cares what they think? They would lose authority in the church. Okay? But these phonies, these faithless, darkened people, okay, they try to present this as an outrage that they would violate this minor detail of canon law. Meanwhile, these same people have no problem with the denial of the divine law, that you have to accept Jesus Christ to be saved. One can see how backwards and upside down it is. They have no problem with the people who reject Jesus Christ's divinity, okay? They promote the very booklet which says heathens can be saved, that people who hate the church can be saved. Meanwhile, they act as if they're outraged that they would dare to transform their lecture program into a school without consulting the heretical Jesuits at the time. This should illustrate to anyone of goodwill how, unfortunately, evil these people are. They're completely faithless. Another example of this is found on page 28, in which they say, quote, "In regard to Father Feeney, he obviously did not obtain the proper permission from ecclesiastical authorities to found a religious congregation," end quote. Well, think about this for a minute. They're criticizing him for not obtaining the proper permission from the ecclesiastical authorities to found a religious congregation. This is a group called the Missionary Sisters of the Holy Ghost, Catholic Research Institute, a completely independent religious group. Who gave them permission to found the group? Nobody. Who do they submit to? No one. So they condemn themselves by this type of argumentation. Further, if they believe that the attitude and the course of action that a Catholic should take is one where he, quote, just submits to what the visible, quote, authorities are saying, then by that very logic, they would have to submit themselves to the Vatican II Church. If they are not to weigh the past dogmatic teachings against what the so-called visible authorities are saying in a fallible capacity, and not supposed to operate outside of that, then, by that very argument, they should submit themselves, quote, humble themselves, and go under the Vatican II Church. But they don't, okay? And so, by employing this kind of argument, they denounce themselves. And so that's the type of thing that's in this heretical booklet, which wouldn't be persuasive to anyone with faith, but only one who is faithless, and, as I said, who is persuaded by faith in man, defends the heretical protocol letter and recommends the outrageously apostate book, Salvation of Non-Catholics. So what I wanted to develop at the beginning of this and show at the end is the link here. This group clearly denies the dogma. They're clearly not Catholic by publishing this book, but and especially Salvation of Non-Catholics. But the same applies to all the Sede Vacantists because, as I said, Bishop Robert McKenna, Father Martin Stepanek, Father Kevin Valancourt all promoted this booklet, Father Feeney the Pope Has Spoken, which in itself promotes the salvation of non-Catholics. Okay, so they all believe this. Now, Bishop McKenna wouldn't be denounced as heretical by someone like Bishop Sanborn or Father Jakata. They would regard him as Catholic. Same thing with Pavaronis of the CMRI. He would regard these people as Catholic. So they all accept this heresy. And everyone who does not denounce these individuals, unfortunately, as heretics, accepts this heresy. There's a clear delineation between the people who believe you have to be a baptized Catholic and hold the Catholic faith and the people who accept baptism desire in this kind of heresy or tolerate it. Clear delineation, and that's why some people wrongly say that we're harsh on some of these groups. No, we're not. We're correctly exposing this evil heresy which destroys faith. Now, another point that I wanted to mention in this program as a final point is the argument that creates many problems for baptism desire, and that's the issue of being born again. I want to quickly mention this, that many people think that St. Alphonsus Liguori's opinion on baptism desire is strong evidence that that's the teaching of the Church. And what they fail to realize is that if you go by the opinion of St. Alphonsus on this issue, you have some insuperable difficulties in reconciling that with Catholic teaching, which I will cover. Before I do that, I want to emphasize that St. Alphonsus did not believe anything remotely with what I just covered. He held that you had to believe in the Trinity, the Incarnation, the essential mysteries of Catholic faith to be saved. That's made clear in many statements by him. He only believed in baptism of desire for someone who believed in the mysteries of Catholic faith. Now, he was wrong about that. He was simply in error on that point. And some people say, well, how is that possible that he could have been in error or wrong about that? Something that is, strictly speaking, not compatible with Catholic dogma. Well, he wrote 111 books, okay? So someone is bound to make mistakes in writing 111 books. St. Thomas Aquinas also made numerous mistakes. And we also have an example in St. Robert Bellarmine, who was a doctor of the Church, who held that geocentrism is de fide. In 1616, when the Holy Office denounced the denial of geocentrism, St. Robert Bellarmine was involved, supportive, aware of what was going on. So he held that geocentrism was de fide, but popes after that, a couple hundred years later, specifically Pope Benedict XIV and others before, and also Pope Benedict XV did not hold that position. So obviously Pope Benedict XV and Pope Benedict XIV and the Holy Office in the 1700s, the 1800s, did not think that St. Robert Bellarmine was correct in holding that geocentrism is de fide. So that's an example of a doctor of the Church holding that something is de fide, which popes themselves did not think was de fide, or even necessarily true. So, but to the point I want to make about St. Alphonsus's clear error in explaining baptism of desire. Baptism of desire is the idea that one can have the grace of the sacrament of baptism without the sacramental character. Okay, that's how it's commonly defined, that it gives you the grace of baptism without the sacramental character. Now, what is the grace of baptism? The grace of baptism, as the Council of Florence defined, is not only the forgiveness of all original and actual sin, but it's also the taking away of all temporal punishment due to sin. That's very important. So it's not only the grace of first justification, but it also removes all temporal punishment due to sin, so that if someone was baptized, he would go straight to heaven when he died. Now, is that how St. Alphonsus defined baptism of desire? Did he say it gave you that grace? The answer is no. In his definition of baptism of desire, he says that it, quote, takes the place of the latter, meaning baptism, with regard to the remission of the guilt, but does not imprint a character nor take away all the debt of punishment, end quote. Think about that. A lot of people just pass right over that, but if you focus in here, he says that baptism of desire takes the place of baptism with regard to the remission of the guilt, meaning it forgives the sins, but does not imprint a character nor take away the debt of punishment. So in other words, a person might have to go to purgatory to satisfy for the temporal punishment due to sin. Well, therefore, he's admitting that it doesn't give you the grace of baptism. And here's the big problem for this. In the Council of Trent's decree on justification and its decree on original sin, it says this. In its decree on justification, chapter 3, this is Denzinger 795, it says, "So unless they were born again in Christ, they never would be justified." Okay? So everyone must agree that you have to be born again in Christ to be justified from original sin. Now, what does being born again mean? Well, in the decree on original sin, Denzinger 792, we read, "For in those who are born again, God hates nothing, because there is no condemnation to those who are truly buried together with Christ by baptism unto death, putting off the old man, putting on the new, who is created according to God. They are made innocent, immaculate, pure, guiltless, beloved sons of God, heirs indeed of God, but co-heirs with Christ, so that there is nothing whatever to retard their entrance into heaven." Let me repeat that. "So that there is nothing whatever to retard their entrance into heaven," end quote. So it's defined that you must be born again. It's defined that being born again means that you receive the forgiveness of everything, the temporal punishment due to sin, so that you would go straight to heaven. Problem for baptism of desire. Because St. Alphonsus, okay, the most probably impressive definition that they could bring forward of baptism of desire, is not compatible with this. Because he admits it doesn't give you the taking away the temporal punishment due to sin. So they would have to admit that it doesn't give you spiritual rebirth, because according to the Council of Trent, spiritual rebirth is the remission of the temporal punishment due to sin. So this is a clear proof that baptism of desire is not reconcilable with Catholic teaching. It's not reconcilable with dogma, and it's a clear proof that St. Alphonsus isn't even explaining it correctly, the way it would have to be explained for it even to begin to be argued. Okay, we know it's false, but this is just a clear example of how it's false. Now, the root of St. Alphonsus' error here is that in the very same context, he tries to substantiate his opinion here by quoting the Council of Trent, Session 14, Chapter 4. Well, that's another error, because Session 14 of the Council of Trent deals with the sacrament of penance. It's not about baptism. And the chapter he's citing is about how someone who desires the sacrament of penance can be justified. Okay, it doesn't say anything about baptism. And so he falsely applies what is said about penance to baptism. And by doing so, that's where he makes the error about the temporal punishment due to sin. Because someone who's justified by his desire for the sacrament of penance doesn't have necessarily the temporal punishment due to his sins forgiven. Whereas in baptism it does. So by trying to apply that, he's simply wrong. He makes a mistake. Many doctors of the church did. And so this is a clear example of how it's not reconcilable with Catholic teaching, how their most, quote, impressive arguments contradict Catholic teaching, how their most impressive arguments don't even explain the position correctly and contradict other things they cite on the issue. So that was just an additional point that I wanted to make, since these comments about the book were relevant because these books recently came up.